If you have your Bibles with you this morning, I want to encourage you to turn with me to Mark chapter 7. If you have not been with us in recent months, you may not know that we have been making our way through the Gospel of Mark. We took about a month break for Christmas, and today we're going to resume right where we left off, near the end of Mark chapter 7. Lord willing, today we will finish up chapter 7 in Mark. Mark 7, verses 24 through 37. The words will be on the screen ahead for you as well. The text tells us this, "And from there he," meaning Jesus of course, "arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.' And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'be opened.' And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, 'He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.'" It's been a number of weeks since we've been in Mark's gospel, and I realize that we may have forgotten a little bit of what we have read in recent months. But if you may recall, as we've encountered these two new healing stories here in Mark 7, that Mark, the beginning, early chapters of Mark are full of many instances where Jesus displays his divine authority and power over the darkness, over demons, over sickness, over even over death. You may remember back in Mark 1 where Jesus heals a leper. In Mark 2, Jesus heals a paralyzed man. In Mark 3, Jesus restores a man's hand that was withered. In Mark 5, Jesus heals a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years on top of bringing a little girl back from the dead. Not a bad day's work, in my mind, being able to do all of those things. Those are just a handful of the miraculous things Jesus does in the early part of his ministry. I think we would be safe to conclude that in the mind of Mark, at least, Jesus is not simply a man. Jesus is not simply a teacher. Jesus is not simply a prophet, a rabbi, a preacher. Jesus is not even simply a worker of miracles. According to Mark, Jesus is all of these things, but really much more. And I think we might conclude that Mark has been, ever since chapter 1, verse 1, Mark has been explaining and defending the claim that he makes, the audacious claim that Mark makes way back in chapter 1 of verse 1 in Mark, which says this: "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." The word Christ means Messiah, so Mark is asserting and claiming that Jesus not only is the long-awaited Messiah of Israel, but also that Jesus is the Son of God. As the Son of God, Jesus can do things that we simply cannot do, such as exorcising demons from a distance and enabling deaf men to hear. As we continue to make our way through Mark this year, I want to invite us all to pull our seats up to the table and learn from Jesus. Learn who he is and what he did. The way that we get to know Jesus better is primarily through reading about him in the Word. How else are we going to learn about his character, his personality, his demeanor, his words, his actions, if we don't take a serious look at what the Word says about him? Our passage today brings us face to face with two more miracles, that miraculous incidents involving Jesus with a woman whose daughter is in need of help, as well as Jesus with a man who is unable to hear and unable to speak without an impediment. Both incidents result in healing for each of for the little girl and also for the man. Jesus does not initiate either of these. In both instances, they bring these needs to him. I believe both incidents highlight his care and concern and compassion for others, as well as visibly display the supremacy and the authority of Jesus really over everything. That's been the reoccurring theme in Mark's gospel up to this, really through the first seven chapters in this gospel, that Jesus has authority over all things. There's nothing that escapes the authority of Jesus. He reigns and he rules, and he's able to do whatever he wants. Let's look at the first encounter. We'll spend most of our time this morning thinking about this first story. Verse 24, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden." The word "there" near the beginning of verse 24 points us back to the first 23 verses in Mark chapter 7. One benefit of studying the Bible consecutively, verse after verse, chapter after chapter, is we always have a frame of reference. We always know the context of what is going on. And the word "there," it refers back to this verbal collision that Jesus had, you may remember, with the Pharisees over the matter, an issue of tradition. The Pharisees claimed and asserted that accused Jesus of not following the tradition of the elders. And we spent a lot of time thinking about what that was. And then you may remember that Jesus points out to the Pharisees that their commitment to following the tradition of the elders actually resulted in them disobeying the clear commands found in the Old Testament. Jesus then goes on to explain where true defilement comes. He says, rather than being defiled by what we touch or by what enters into our body, Jesus says it's actually the opposite. The things which proceed out of the person defiles the person, and everything that proceeds out of the person flows from what Jesus calls the heart, which in the Bible represents the center of one's being, including the mind and the emotions and the will. You may recall verses 20 and 21 in Matthew 7. If you have your Bibles, look at these verses really quickly. "And Jesus said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, and then a number of other things." Jesus makes the case here that spiritually speaking, we need much more than a heart cath and some stents. Right? Much more is involved if we're going to be reconciled with God. If we're going to be reconciled with God, Jesus says we need a total heart transplant, which, friends, incidentally, is the very reason why Jesus came, to give us something that we can't do ourselves. To my knowledge, no one has ever performed a heart transplant on themselves. If you're in that bad of shape, you need someone else to do the work for you. In church, spiritually speaking, that's how the Bible describes our predicament with our sin. We need someone else from the outside to come in and intervene on our behalf, which is exactly why Jesus came. So Jesus is in Tyre, T-Y-R-E, a Gentile region nearby. Gentile meaning non-Jewish, so he's no longer in Israel. He's across the border into this other region, and he enters a home, and for whatever reason, the text doesn't tell us, he enters a home, and he does not want to be found. We can speculate as to why he didn't want to be bothered. I think he was probably just tired from the demands of ministry. Probably he was exhausted by the Pharisees. That's what I think is going on here. He's tired of dealing with them, tired of their hard-heartedness, tired of their legalism, and yet Jesus finds no rest. The text says, yet he could not be hidden. Who finds him? Verse 25, "But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet." Few things motivate adults more than sick children. Than your own sick children, if I can clarify that. If you're a parent, or if you had children at one time, obviously in your home, that were young, you know and remember that when your kids are sick, we will, as parents, will do nearly anything we can to help our children get better, to help our children be healed. And that's what's going on here in this passage. This woman is desperate. We know she's desperate because she falls down at the feet of Jesus. Typically, we don't do that unless we are really in need of that person to help us. Probably none of us here have ever prostrated ourselves down before any other human being. I don't think I ever have. I don't guess I've ever been that desperate or in need of someone to help me in such a way as this woman does. But this is what this woman does. Verse 25 says that she found Jesus. And here verse 26 gives us a little more information about who this woman is. Now, the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. We've already noted that Jesus was in Gentile territory, and yet Mark wants to make it crystal clear that the person, that the woman that Jesus is about to interact with is also a Gentile. She's Syrophoenician by birth. From the Jewish perspective at that time, she was outside of God's chosen people. She was outside the family, so to speak. She was not a child of God because she was a Gentile, a non-Jew. And so I think what Mark is wanting us to know here, and we'll see this better in just a moment, is that she really has no leg to stand on with Jesus as far as getting help from him. You see, because the way things worked back then, Jewish rabbis, it really wasn't customary for a Gentile woman to approach a Jewish rabbi in this matter. But as we see already, as we'll see in just a little bit, she didn't care. Her daughter was possessed by a demon, and she desperately needed Jesus to help her. So what did she do? The text says that she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. In the Greek, the word for beg is in the present tense, meaning she did this on a continual basis. She begged and begged and begged until she became a nuisance. You say, I don't see that in the text. Where do you see that in the text? Well, we don't see it in Mark's gospel, but you may remember that Matthew tells this same story over in his gospel. And so the parallel account in Matthew, for example, verse 23 says this. After she is saying, begging Jesus to heal her or to heal her daughter, the text actually says that Jesus doesn't respond at all to her request initially. Verse 23 of Matthew 15, but he did not answer her a word, which is unusual for Jesus. Certainly when this woman is so desperate, she really needs his help. And according to the text, Jesus does not answer her at all. Here's this lady falling at the feet of Jesus, imploring him to heal her daughter, and Jesus says nothing. Look at what we see next in the text. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, for she is crying out after us. So there's a lot of begging going on in this story. The woman is literally begging Jesus to heal her daughter, and the disciples are also begging Jesus to send this woman away. The text says she won't stop crying out after us. She's getting on their nerves from the disciples' perspective, and she wants Jesus to send her away. Matthew's account provides a couple other details that are important for us to understand. Verses 24 and 25. Jesus answered. So now he answers her. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. So if you remember much about the first 7.5 chapters of Mark, you may remember that nearly all of the ministry that Jesus has done up until this point has been with his own people. He crossed over into the Gentile territory once, maybe twice, but for the most part, all that he was doing, all the healings he was doing, the teaching he was doing, 90% of it was within Israel, his own people. We know for the most part that his own people rejected him, but Jesus says here in Matthew's version of this story that he was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We know from reading the rest of the Gospels and the New Testament that Jesus came not only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but Jesus came for the lost sheep everywhere. For example, in Matthew 28, the Great Commission, Jesus tells his disciples, go therefore and make disciples of what? Of Israel? No, he says, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, of all people groups. So we know that Jesus' mission included more than just Jewish people, but at this point, his understanding of his own mission had to do primarily with the people of Israel. But even despite Jesus saying that, this woman is persistent, isn't she? I love just the tenderness that verse 25 communicates to us. After Jesus said this, what happens? But she came, the woman, came and knelt before him saying, Lord, help me. She has nowhere else to turn. She's at the end of her rope. Her daughter is possessed by this demon. And she knows that Jesus is really the last and only hope that she has for bringing healing to her daughter. And she's desperate. And she understands that Jesus really is the answer to her problem. So after the disciples try to get Jesus to show, to move her on, she falls at the feet of Jesus and offers this simple but really profound prayer of desperation. Lord, help me. What we know about Jesus up to this point in Mark really doesn't prepare us, I don't think, for what Jesus says next in the text. I've already read the text, so you know what he says. But as we think about this in more of in the context of the story now, what Jesus says next to the woman, based on what we know, based on the condition of her daughter, based on the desperation that she feels at the current time, what Jesus says next is at minimum odd. It's a little unusual. It's a bit insensitive, and it could be just downright offensive, depending on how you take these words and how you translate it and interpret it. All of these things are really true, I think, to some degree, of what Jesus says. Look at what Jesus says next. Remember everything we've talked about so far. And he said to her, so here's this woman down on her knees in front of Jesus, Lord, help me, offers this profoundly humble, innocent prayer of desperation, and listen to what Jesus says to her. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Okay? Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Again, as we think about what we read in Matthew's account, it helps us understand what Jesus means, what he says here in verse 27. This is a parable of sorts, a metaphor, if you will. And on one level, I think the simplest level, what Jesus is describing here is a scene common to many homes. If you have a pet at home that you allow inside, sometimes around the meal, around the table, your pets will come in hoping to get something to eat, right? And even if you consider your pet to be a child or part of your family, most people that I know still give the priority to their own kids first, right? At least to my knowledge, most of us do. Even if you love your pet profoundly, you're still going to prepare your children's food first before you prepare your pet's food. Children nearly always take priority over pets. But I think Jesus has more in mind here, and this is really where Matthew gives us some help. Based on what Jesus says in Matthew, the children that Jesus mentioned here, I believe represent the people of Israel. Remember what Jesus says right before he said this. He said, I was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So the children represents the people of Israel. The bread that's mentioned here, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. The bread represents the teaching and preaching ministry of Jesus, if not the entirety of Jesus' ministry overall. His life, his death, his resurrection. I believe all of that is encapsulated in this word bread. And here's where we get to the kind of the offensive part. The dogs, therefore, a dog is kind of the theme of our service today. The dog was in the deacon video, and dogs are found in our text this morning. The dogs then, if all of this follows, the children and the bread, then who would the dogs represent? The dogs would represent Gentiles. So Jesus, in some sense, is calling this woman who is in a desperate spot right to her face. He is calling her a dog. And by most people's estimation, this would have been an offensive thing for Jesus to do, a term of reproach. He was not complimenting this woman or complimenting the Gentiles here. He's not being very politically correct. If he lived today, he would no doubt be scolded on the nightly news and vilified on Twitter for saying what he says here. But Jesus is God. And sometimes we don't like what Jesus has to say. And this may offend us when we think, as far as I know, none of us are Jewish by birth or by race. And so it could be that we're a little offended by that as well, that Jesus would have the audacity and have the nerve to say that he really didn't come to save us first, that we're not really the first priority in his mission, that his mission really was about saving the lost sheep of Israel. But if that's how we feel, then really it's just too bad, right? Because the text tells us, Jesus is clear why he came. He came to serve and save primarily the Jewish people first. There's a priority here. One commentator says that this comment that Jesus makes, it points to, quote, a priority of mission in salvation history, and God determined for things to be done a certain way. And Jesus came first and foremost to rescue and to save Jewish people. But unlike our response at times to what Jesus says here, maybe we're a little offended by that, this woman takes it all in stride, and she replies with an incredibly wise and humble response. Listen to what she says in verse 28. After Jesus says what he does, this is what we find. But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Listen to what one Robert Stein commentator says. He says, her reply acknowledged the truth of Jesus' previous statement, referring to what he said. The Jew held a privileged position in the divine order of salvation history, but with great wit and faith, she responded that she was not seeking to take away the children's bread, like a dog, merely to share in their leftover crumbs. I wonder, friends, if we would have enough humility about us to respond to Jesus in that same way. I don't know if I would. I think if I were her, probably, and Jesus said that to me, I think I would just go on. Right? Obviously, Jesus, from her perspective at this point, didn't really seem like he wanted to help her. And then he offends her, perhaps, with this, could have offended her with this term. And yet she responds in just a beautiful way, demonstrating just how humble she was. Back in Matthew's account in verse 22, we find this woman asking for mercy. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." Much about this woman is worthy of our emulation, right? Her humility is on display here. She postures herself before Jesus as a beggar in need of food. She doesn't try to impress Jesus with her credentials, but rather assumes the role of one in need. And she asks Jesus to have mercy on her. But she's not afraid to help either. She's very assertive here. She recognizes her desperate spot, but she's not shy about asking Jesus to help her. Listen to what pastor and author Tim Keller says. He says, in Western cultures, we don't have anything like this kind of assertiveness. We only have the assertiveness of our rights. We do not know how to contend unless we're standing up for our rights, standing on our dignity and our goodness, saying, this is what I'm owed. But this woman is not doing that at all. This is rightless assertiveness, something we know little about. She's not saying, Lord, give me what I deserve on the basis of my goodness. She's saying, give me what I don't deserve on the basis of your goodness, and I need it now. Is this not also just a snapshot of of salvation, really. As Christians, we understand that we're not saved because of some intrinsic good and value within us. We are saved only because of the goodness of God, the grace of God, that He would look upon sinners like us, and even though we deserve hell and condemnation, God would look upon us and love us and send His only Son to this earth to live and die and be resurrected on our behalf, in our place. That's what salvation is all about. Here in this story, we find really a snapshot of grace and the posture that we must assume if and when we also will come to faith in Jesus. If we come to faith in Jesus, we must be like this woman and not plead our own goodness, but cast ourselves at the mercy of Jesus. Jesus is pleased with her humility. He's pleased with her assertiveness, and I believe he's pleased with her faithfulness. Verses 29 and 30. And He said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." Can you imagine having the ability to do that? Just Jesus is unlike any other. Verse 30, and she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. In Matthew's account, Jesus is talking to the woman after she gives her response, and He exclaims, "O woman, great is your faith." So the woman's faith is commended by Jesus. Her humility, I believe, is commended as well. Let's look very quickly at the second encounter Jesus has. Verse 31, kind of the transition verse here in these two passages, gives us some travel details. We learn Jesus is back in the Sea of Galilee, the region of the Decapolis. Again, a person that is in need of attention is brought to Him. Jesus is not seeking these people out. They bring him to Jesus. Verse 32, and they brought to Him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged Him to lay His hand on him. This time there's no parable. There's no snippy response by Jesus. There's no testing of her faith or testing of this guy's faith. All there is here is simply grace and love and mercy. Look at verses 33 and following. And taking Him aside from the crowd privately, He put His fingers into His ears and after spitting, touched His tongue. And looking up to heaven, He sighed and said to Him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And His ears were opened, His tongue was released, and He spoke plainly. Can you imagine what it must have been like to observe that, to witness that, this miracle that Jesus performs for this man? What's interesting about this particular healing, and if not the entirety of Mark's gospel, and really all four gospels, is how much Jesus is the exact fulfillment of what was written about Him in the Old Testament, what was written about the Messiah in the Old Testament. Many commentators see a direct connection between this particular healing miracle with what we read in Isaiah chapter 35, written 700 years before Jesus was born. Listen to these words in Isaiah and see if you don't see echoes of Jesus all over this passage. Isaiah says this, strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame leap like a deer, the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. So there was already this anticipation that had been amongst the Jewish people for hundreds of years that the Messiah was going to come and do exactly what the Messiah did here at the very end of Matthew 7. The aftermath of this story is reminiscent from earlier parts in Mark. Look at verses 36 and 37 as we close. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. So He's healed this deaf man. He's able to speak. And Jesus says, don't tell anybody. But the more He charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." Let's pray.